Welcome to a Talk Nation radio special on Ned Lamont, who was speaking in Mansfield, Connecticut, April 22nd, about the first 100 days of the Obama administration.
I take what I see Obama's doing on the national level and look at what we're doing here in the state of Connecticut. And here I think our political leadership, starting with the governor, has consistently underestimated the scale of the problems confronting our state.
Ned Lamont won an upset victory in the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in 2006, and then a tight race ensued with Joe Lieberman. He ran as an independent and won. But at the moment, Lamont seems more interested in a run against Republican Governor Jody Rell in 2010.
Well, it's health care. You know, it's nursing homes. We ought to be looking at home health care for more and more of our elderly. It's corrections. We have twice as many people in prison today as we had just 25 years ago. You know, most of that increase is related to sort of low-level drug-related crimes.
This is Dory Smith, producer of Talk Nation Radio, which is now produced in our new Talk Nation Radio studios in Mansfield, Connecticut. Lamont spoke before a friendly crowd of several dozen people gathered at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield, Connecticut, and was introduced by John Myers of the Northeast Connecticut United Nations Association, co-sponsor of the event along with the local office of Citizens for Global Solutions.
Very briefly, introduction for Ned Lamont, who is, as you know, a former senatorial candidate for the state of Connecticut in 2006. He's the founder and chairman of Lamont Digital Systems down in Greenwich, and on the board of Mercy Corps Conservation Services Group, Teach for America Connecticut. And he also chairs the Arts and Sciences Public Policy Committee at Central Connecticut State University. It's a pleasure to welcome him, and the floor is yours, Ned.
Thank you, John and George and everybody, and respondents, get ready. I think maybe I'll just have some fun. I just came back from a trip to the Middle East, so I'll start maybe from the Middle Eastern point of view of the world and then take it closer to home in the course of 15 minutes. But actually, John and I got together a couple of weeks ago because I had the amusing fortune of taking Ted Turner around the state of Connecticut, just the most remarkable guy. You know, you got to remember, he was a billboard guy 30 years ago. Then everybody laughed at me when he said, I'm going to create the first all-news network. And I just reminded of it as I travel around the world. CNN is the go-to network that people are paying attention to, certainly in the Middle East and beyond. And today he's dedicating his life to eradication of nuclear weapons from the world. So he's a man who's not afraid to take on big challenges. First thing I found, I was over in the Middle East. I just got back a few days ago over there with Mercy Corps that John mentioned is an NGO. We do small business development. You think about nuclear weapons. In the United States, we think of, the nuclear madmen, guys like Kim Jong-il and Ahmadinejad from Iran. But over in that part of the world, we were in Syria, we were in Beirut, we were in the West Bank and Gaza and Israel. Iran, there's a certain different perception of Iran. Wherever you go, Iran's got an extraordinary influence as a builder. I mean, for example, you go to Damascus, Syria, and Damascus is a fairly prosperous town. I mean, one of the things you learn as an American is, you know, we don't do business with Damascus. We don't do business with Syria. We have an embargo. But embargoes don't work if we're the only guy doing the embargo. And, you know, Japan and Western Europe is there, and Sony and Nissan, and it's a city that is doing just fine, but there are about 700,000 Iraqi refugees living in this city of a few million people. 700,000. They, at this point, don't seem to want to go back to Iraq, even if you think the violence is diminishing. And President Assad from Syria definitely doesn't want them staying. So they're sort of in Netherland. The reason I mention Iran is that you've got 700,000 Iraqis living, you know, four or five families to an apartment. They sold everything they had in Baghdad so they could afford to live here. And right in the middle of this Shia community in Damascus is an enormous mosque that was built by Iran. And that's how they think about Iran and that part of Syria. Then you drive a few hours over snow-capped mountains, you know, into Beirut, Lebanon. I forgot that there was really good skiing in Lebanon. You can ski down almost to the Med and then go swimming that afternoon. And there I was reminded of Iran again because, You know, northern part of Beirut is Christian Beirut. It's fairly modern. They've got, you know, pictures of Michael Jordan and George Clooney selling Torno watches. But you go to the southern part of Beirut, and that's Hezbollah Beirut. And there, and you know it's Hezbollah because on every single lamppost, there'll be a poster with black bunting of a suicide bomber who has, you know, been killed in battle or martyred himself. So you know exactly where these folks are coming from. And there we met, you know, the mayor of this small, this city within a city in South Beirut. And he was cynical as could be. And I just remember him saying, I'm a mayor, but I'm also a builder. I'm a contractor. And over every couple of years, Israel bombs, the buildings are destroyed, and Iran pays me to rebuild the buildings. War is good for business. I mean, it was an extraordinary attitude that you heard. And then John got me over at the World Affairs Council a few weeks ago, and General Petraeus was there. You know, a fascinating man, by the way. He understands the importance of the military, but he also understands the importance of soft power and diplomacy and civil affairs and rebuilding things. He has a PhD in international affairs from Princeton. And he came up to me with a bit of a grin, and he said, Ned, I guess you got to say in hindsight, the surge worked, didn't it? And I said, well, you know, General, you know, really what's happened in the last couple of years is we started paying the Sunni militia, the Awakening Councils, directly. And they in turn stood up and stopped fighting the Shias and started fighting Al-Qaeda. So to that degree, you know, we saw some benefit. But General, in the last couple of months, the al-Maliki government, the Shia government that controls Baghdad, has stopped paying the Awakening Councils, the Sunnis in Anbar. And that's why you see the beginning of some violence again. And secondly, General, the political issues have not been resolved, and we're never going to have peace in Iraq until those political issues are resolved. So when it comes to whether or not the surge is working, I'd have to say it's time will tell, but it's too early to say. And by the way, General, I got to say, 7 years later, I think we have to say that the invasion of Iraq was a terrible strategic blunder for the United States of America. Cost us over $1 trillion, blood and treasure, and the great strategic winner of our invasion was, again, Iran. And he just looked at me with a nice grin and he said, it's too early to say, time will tell. So we could talk a little bit more about foreign policy, but if the Obama-Bush strategy over the last year going forward was all about the surge and what we're going to do in Afghanistan, back here closer to home, as we look up at the financial crisis, are we not about the surge, but really is about the splurge. And that is probably $2 trillion that the federal government has committed over the last 6 or 8 months to work through what was our financial system right on the edge of a precipice. You know, it's a number that we don't really appreciate, but it's not only the money that we borrow, and a lot of that money went to the stimulus bill, and we should talk about that. But it's also the Federal Reserve and the guarantees they make to make sure that those toxic assets don't take down Citigroup. And it's the money that we print. So it's $2 trillion. But it's worth remembering that that's not money. A lot of that money will come back to the taxpayer and will come back to the government. So it's a little bit of a misnomer when they say we're just throwing that money out the door, you know, never to be seen again. But Obama, when he was elected, you know, inherited an extraordinary mess. And I don't think the previous administration, a lot of the political class, understood how dangerous the situation was. I mean, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, the Depression was about 3.5 years after the Great Crash, 3.5 years. The stock market was down about 80-85%. There was probably 25% or 30% unemployment when FDR took over, but things were beginning to stabilize. You maybe remember nothing to fear but fear itself. But the first thing Franklin Roosevelt did when elected or inaugurated was he shut down the banks. He called it a bank holiday. And I think he dealt head on with a financial crisis. And I think Obama's been very good at dealing head on with a financial crisis. And if it was me, I think I'd maybe lean a little more towards what FDR did, taking over the banks, cleaning up the banks, and putting them public. Instead, we have a strategy where we're going to pay, you know, hedge fund managers and private investors to buy up those toxic assets. We can have a dispute or discussion about whether that's the right strategy or not. But at the end of the day, we had a financial system that was right on the edge, and we're relatively more stable today than we were. And I think that gives our country the wind to our back, a little better hope. And I got to say that I think the Republican response to the Obama economic strategy has been absolutely incoherent. Some of them say, hey, look, we've got to balance the budget, and we can't borrow from our kids' future. I mean, these Republicans were the ones that were spending us like drunken sailors back during the prosperous times. And for them now to talk about balancing the budget, you know, either raising taxes or cutting spending in the jaws of a recession like we have is the exact wrong prescription. And I will remind you, that's what FDR ended up doing in 1937. The country was on the mend, and we went back into a tailspin because we took those old policies. The other half of the Republicans go the other direction. They say, I think we ought to just stop taxing for the next, year or two and see whether tax cuts will be able to grow our way out of this recession. I think they've been wrong on both fronts. I don't know why, but I went on the Sean Hannity show. Did you? I mean, he's sort of a sketch, this guy. I mean, he comes in, he's dressed, you know, to the nines from here up, you know, pinstripe suit, but he's got, you know, jeans and sandals the rest of the way. And, you know, he was saying, you know, I think this Obama stimulus plan is European socialism, remember? And he said, I can't believe that they're going to help bail out the states. Well, my company, we provide telecommunication services to college campuses, including a couple hundred thousand student rooms in California. So I told Sean Hannity off camera that, look, the gubernator from the governor of had said, if we don't get the stimulus money, he's going to have to start paying everybody with IOUs. And Sean, then I will pay Rupert Murdoch with IOUs, and he can pay you with IOUs since we do distribute your show sometimes. And then he went on and asked me about octuplets or something. And then, you know, that Bobby Jindal, I mean, remember him? He gave the response and he said, I think this stimulus money is an extraordinary waste. It shouldn't be allowed. And I feel so strongly about that that I'm going to refuse to accept 0.00001% of the money. I mean, I'm afraid the states were on the edge of bankruptcy. The states were on the edge of bankruptcy, and I think what Obama tackled, he tackled it well, and he didn't underestimate the scale of the problem. You know, the latest critique of the Obama economic plan is he's trying to do too much at the same time. He's trying to jumpstart the economy. He's trying to deal with healthcare and bring down the costs and expand accessibility. He's trying to change the nature of our energy economy in a fundamental way. He can't walk and chew gum at the same time. You've heard that line. But the point is that we will never get this economy right unless we deal with the healthcare and the energy situation simultaneous to working this thing through. And I think what I'm proud to have been involved in the Obama campaign from the beginning is I think, unlike a lot of the other politicians in the political class, he's seen the gravity of the economic situation we're confronted with, and he's hitting it head on, and I think he's giving us a great deal of confidence. I'll just close by saying I take what I see Obama's doing on the national level and look at what we're doing here in the state of Connecticut. And here I think our political leadership, starting with the governor, has consistently underestimated the scale of the problems confronting our state. I mean, it was last fall, back when the economy was falling off the edge, and Governor Rell said, well, I think we're going to we can balance the budget. We'll turn out the lights in our offices in the evening. We'll probably cut back on out-of-state travel, and we'll see if we can keep drinking at Foxwoods, open 24 hours a day. We can get a little more revenue that way. And I don't mean to be sarcastic, but we consistently underestimated the scale of the problem. And here we are. Look, we're a state. We haven't added a net new job in 25 years. We've got young people are leaving the state in droves. We got about the same demographics as Florida, same average age right now. Our cities are dying. And maybe this crisis was an opportunity for a fresh start for the state of Connecticut. You know, we got a deficit that's 25% out of whack. You know, a $16 billion budget and about a $4 to $5 billion deficit. So we're not going to be able to fix it by nibbling around the edges. And I was so disappointed, you know, when the governor came before the legislature. Now, here you go. You know, she's got a 75% approval rating. We've got a budget that's about to, you know, implode. This is your chance to be a leader. This is your chance. I think the business community, I think the labor community, people are really ready to get around the table and come up with an honest budget. And instead, you know, we were just talking to a few friends here, you know, she said, look, I'm going to take, you know, the $30 million from the clean election funds, and maybe we can balance the budget that way, which I didn't, you know, this is the party that, you know, brought us, you know, pay-to-play scandals. It's not a serious solution. She said, I'm going to take the money from the energy efficiency funds. We were talking about that. These are the monies so that, you know, working-class folks can make their houses energy efficient. She said, we're going to borrow from our state pension funds. Well, our state pension funds, I can tell you right now, are bankrupt. So there's no borrowing from that. And it was just a terrible disappointment. And by the way, she said, I can't balance the budget. I'm going to leave it on Don Williams' desk. Here's $2 billion more that you see if you can figure that out. It was just a terrible wasted opportunity. And I think this was the time for the governor. I think it's the time for our legislature to deal with the fundamental reforms that get this state going forward again. I mean, if you look at where the expenses are, what are the lines that are going up, you know, like this? Well, it's health care. You know, it's nursing homes. We ought to be looking at home health care for more and more of our elderly. It's corrections. We have twice as many people in prison today as we had just 25 years ago. You know, most of that increase is related to sort of low-level drug-related crimes. And by the same token, we're paying, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in overtime to our prison workers, spending more now on prisons than we are, you know, in higher education. I think we have to look at a lot of the work rules, frankly, when it comes to the unions, and make sure that people can work in the most efficient way possible. No more, you know, last hired, first fired. I think there's some real compromises we have to make. And once you've done that, I think you have to look at tax reform as well, so we get this state on a stable basis going forward. And that when we get the wind to our back, we're going to be able to start this economy growing again. And I just leave you with, you know, people tell me, well, these things take a long time. You know, and healthcare reform for Obama is going to take a long time. And peace in the Middle East is going to take a long time. And getting an energy independent economy is going to do that. And these reforms in Connecticut. And I always loved that line from, you know, Jack Kennedy when he was president of the United States. And he said, I want a shade tree right over there. And the gardener said, well, Mr. President, I got to tell you, it's going to take 20 years for that shade tree to grow. And he said, well, you better plant it this morning. And I think that's the type of planning that we've got to do in the state of Connecticut. You know, I see that leadership in Washington. I couldn't be prouder. I can tell you, just as I went around the Middle East, I got these diatribes from the Syrian foreign minister and, you know, Palestinian Authority and young kids, you know, on the beach in Gaza, which has, you know, just suffered a terrible war. But they'd always end up each and every conversation saying, tell me about Barack Obama, and do you think he'll be able to make a difference? And I think one of the things I love about our country is we make slip on a lot of banana peels and do a lot of stupid things, but I look back at Lincoln and Roosevelt and hopefully Obama. Somehow we seem to get it right when the times are tough, and I hope we're doing that now. Thanks for inviting me back. It's great to be here.
That was Ned Lamont speaking to an audience at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield, Connecticut, known affectionately as Charlie's Church, for local peace activist and educator Charles Pruitt. After his talk, I had the opportunity to ask Ned Lamont about the question of founding a state bank, something a previous guest on the show, Ellen Hodgson Brown, had discussed. North Dakota's state bank has helped the state remain solvent through the current economic crisis. This was Ned Lamont's reply.
We have taken over the major banks in this country. Citicorp, Citigroup is insolvent. AIG is insolvent. Those are almost nationalized in everything but name right now. And it is you know, the federal administrators who are making the calls. And the disappointment is, with all the money that's gone into Citigroup, they're not increasing their lending, which is still choking up the financial system. I don't know about the state-run banks and North Dakota or wherever, but I think you're going to find more and more states being a lender of last resort, using pension money, using ways to get some liquidity, leveraging up what our other banks are doing so they can get some money flowing again, and I think it probably makes some sense.
When local residents expressed concern about the Obama administration's position on the banking industry and the Middle East, he had support for the president.
I think that Obama's doing some pretty big things, and he's not landed steady habits. I mean, he is going to totally re-regulate the entire financial sector of our economy. The biggest mistake we made was in 2004, to your question, when the SEC said banks can borrow as much money as they want. So all of a sudden, Lehman Brothers had leverage. You know, they had 35 or 40 to 1. They put $1 down for every $40 thing that they bought. So if that piece of real estate lost a little bit of value, we were all on the hook for it. It was a disaster. If you look what he's doing on healthcare, he wants to create an entire public vehicle, a Medicare for all type of thing. You may say, well, why is he leaving the private healthcare system in place? I think he's sort of smart. He's saying, I'm going to give people a choice. If they like their private health system, they can stay with it, but they're also going to offer a public vehicle that allows small business and individuals on a sliding scale. I think it's an enormous transformation. And in this environment, to be talking about a carbon tax or a cap and trade, which will fundamentally change the dynamic about how we use energy and how we pay for it, I mean, these are not trifling things that he's dealing with. I'll respond in just two ways. I mean, I spent a fair amount of time a few years ago, you know, arguing with Joe Lieberman about the war in Iraq and whether a timeline was appropriate or timeline sent a message to our enemies and how we could fundamentally change course. And I can tell you our major combat operations end over there on August 1st. And I can tell you that our combat troops are out of there a year thereafter. And whether that bends or fuzzes, I don't know, but I know we've come so far on that issue compared to where we are a couple of years ago. I have a certain confidence that our commander-in-chief has taken us in the right direction. I share the trepidation you guys do when it comes to Afghanistan. I mean, the Soviets had 180,000 troops in Afghanistan, and we're going to go from whatever it is, 30 to 50. And you sort of say, well, what are we doing? Are we going to patrol the Khyber Pass? You know what Afghanistan is? You know what their economy is? It's one half foreign aid and one half drugs. That's it. That's the entire GDP. I don't know. Maybe you eradicate the drugs, double the foreign aid, give people an alternative, give them some real hope there. Don't do that militarily. And that's what our European allies want us to do. You know, talk about a coalition of the willing. Maybe we go in alongside our European allies, and that's how you can make a bigger difference.
University of Connecticut student government comptroller Jason Ortiz also drew heavy praise for his presentation on ways the state could save money.
I kind of come from a community organizing standpoint. I recently got involved in student government, but prior to that, I was involved a lot more environmental work or against the war work or anything that's much more on a community level, not so much on a legal level. But it actually changed significantly this year when I started to work on one of the issues that you sort of brought up with the overcrowding of prisons and who is exactly in our prisons. And a lot of those people are young, nonviolent drug offenders. And it's very interesting to kind of tie these all in together because it really does come down to the budget crisis that's really affecting us right now and sort of the stonewall that the governor is putting in front of us when it comes to the decriminalization of marijuana. And we've actually been working a lot with the budget at UConn and trying to get as much information as we possibly can, but it's really frustrating because they can't form their numbers until Hartford forms their numbers. So it's hard for us to try to figure out what our best actions are and how to approach these different things when we don't really have all the numbers, when nobody has all the numbers. But it's interesting because the University of Connecticut is facing about $11 million budget gap at stores anyway. And that is slightly lower than the amount projected that we would save from the decriminalization of marijuana. So it's very frustrating to see such a correlation and, you know, cause and effect here and like where the money could go immediately if we were to do this and still not see any movement on this particular issue. But it's great that despite a lot of these budget problems that we're having, like to see the University of Connecticut campus right now is an extremely active environment. And I've never seen so many events going on week after week on various issues, environmentalism, human rights, social justice. And we even have an entirely new program of creative community building run out of the General Studies Department. And this program, absolutely, yeah, I mean, that's something that should be applauded. Because this is a program that is not necessarily available in a lot of other places because non-UConn degree-seeking students can join the classes. So there's a lot of age, you know, interaction when it comes to the different classes that are going on in this program. So it's interesting to see sort of some parts of UConn grow during the budget crisis, but at the same time, we're losing a lot of our really vital parts of what make UConn amazing. And one of the things that frustrated me recently was the closing of the Benton. And the idea that in order to save money, we need to remove a lot of everything that makes UConn what it is. And it was really disappointing to see the hours cut at the Benton and our library hours cut. And a lot of the core things that make it different than other places are where we're going to sort of cut, you know, pieces here and there. And I think it was interesting that you brought up that it's not going to happen from nitpicking little pieces here and there, that we need to make some real, very, very different ideas of what's going on. And recently, we've also had an issue with police entering students' dorm rooms and houses in order to make sure they're not selling marijuana to the public. And I understand that this is a problem, you know, on a national scale with, you know, drug use, but I'm sure our tax money could be spent a little better than hiring 6 police officers to go into a dorm room with a dog to get an 18-year-old kid while he's sleeping in his dorm room. And it became really frustrating to me, and I have to bring this up today because I was called last night by 2 separate students. And I work for the group called Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And these students came to me saying, what is going to happen to me? What is going to go? Like, I just want to stay in school. That's all I want is to stay in school. I don't care if they pay anything, if I have to do any kind of test. I don't care. I want to stay in school. And so we're in a situation where we're forcing these kids in these very negative and like intense emotional situations, and we really don't have to. Like, there's something that could absolutely, with a stroke of a pen, be eliminated from our state and provide $11 million back and to pay for all the programs that we had before. So I share your frustrations with Hartford and sort of just stonewalling like obvious solutions to problems regardless of the public's input. I mean, UConn did a study that said over 60% of Connecticut support the decriminalization of marijuana. This is a legitimate study done by the University of Connecticut. So to see these facts and these numbers come up and still not see any progress is very frustrating when, from a student's perspective, we are growing in activism and growing in energy. And because of the Obama administration, how he really got a lot of the young people involved, and we're not utilizing that. We're dampening it at UConn, and it's frustrating. I think the students would like to see some more leadership from the state when it comes to protecting education as a vital part of Connecticut. Because if there's anything that brings people to Connecticut, it's our education system. And I think this is a big reason why we have, you know, an amazing pool of talent that goes through our universities, but then leaves afterwards because there's no, you know, opportunities for them. And I grew up in Norwich, so I knew very well how the impact of having the casinos around impacted your, you know, look on the future. Because there was many people that were college graduates that then went to be blackjack dealers. And I feel that's a really serious issue when we have people going to school for things they're passionate about, but the casinos just pay much better because they just can't. They can provide benefits. If you have a family, they can help you out with childcare and various aspects. So I think the pinnacle of Connecticut right now really needs to be reforming our education system, because we're closing elementary schools, we're condensing high schools, and throwing nonviolent kids in jail for doing something that is not harming anyone. We're wasting a lot of money on what is our most vital resource, is the students. So I really think if we could address this and use it as a launching pad for, we're not gonna continue the same failed strategies of the past, because this is not a time to continue to do the same thing that has proven to not work. And I think this is a way to generate both money and, you know, respect and sympathy from the community if we can really look at education and focus on that first, and I think we'll be able to build out from there afterwards.
The mic was handed back over to Ned Lamont.
You know, as the mayor said, the property tax situation in this state, we have the highest property taxes around, are killing our cities and towns. And what that means is we have greater inequality of income than just about any state in the country. That's reflected in education, that's reflected in poverty. And as you pointed out, it's also reflected in terms of open space, because we're driving development out of our cities, and they've taken over more and more of the open space, the opposite of what a small state like Connecticut should do, which is develop our basic infrastructure in and around our urban centers. Connecticut was at its best when Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport were 3 of the richest cities in the country, and now they're 3 of the poorest. And your comment, I think, on education, both of you, was right on target. You say, what is one of the great strategic advantages that Connecticut has is some of the most extraordinary universities in the world, starting with UConn and Yale. And this is where I think Connecticut's got to be a lot smarter. You look what California was able to do around Stanford and Berkeley and Silicon Valley. You look what Massachusetts was able to do around Route 128. And I think that's the future of an area like this. If UConn, for example, says that clean tech and clean energy is going to be a significant part of our future, that's where we're going to put some of our efforts. That gives kids an alternative that keeps them out of jail, keeps them in the state, and keeps the state growing. And it's really about growth, I think, that's our future.
For Talk Nation Radio in Mansfield, Connecticut, I'm Dori Smith. Our website is talknationradio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.